KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Enlighten us, but make it quick. That's the premise of Ignite Seattle, a yearly event where presenters get 5 minutes and 20 slides to get a point across. This year's event touches on a variety of topics, including artistry, forgiveness, the environment, and even the fear of public speaking itself. Ignite Seattle took place at Town Hall on November 8, 2012, and was moderated by Seattle Times columnist Monica Guzman. Coming up, Josh Marr talks about the definition of running.
Thank you. I'm Josh Marr, author of The Definition of Running. I did run a half marathon to get here to talk tonight, and I felt like that the whole way. About the same that I felt like when I was three running, and that was before my hippie parents reformed and they stuffed my feet into shoes, and then I fell victim to the fallacy that we all are a victim of, that running is painful. You know, 17% of people who run on their heels are smiling when they're running, while 43% of people who run on their forefoot are smiling. Smiling while running is scientific proof that they're happy. The problem is the definition, or lack thereof. The definition is of running, in the dictionary, that moving fast with long strides and both feet momentarily off the ground. I don't think Merriam and Webster were runners. I don't think that they explained it very well. And the running industry, the $3 billion running industry, has inserted themselves into this problem of definition. And they just did it to sell you more shoes. Overpronation, underpronation, shock absorption, whatever they wanted to call it, they want you to buy shoes 4 to 6 times a year. So, like everyone else, 76% of runners started running. They just, no instruction, no coaching, no books, and they hit the pavement, got stuck at a store, a running shoe store, and a pimply-faced kid shoved their shoes or feet into shoes to fix their gait. But when you were young, what did you do when you wanted to run? You just took off your shoes and you ran. The human body has evolved, and that evolution on your toes, your knees, your hips, your rib cage, your shoulders, has really designed you to be a running machine. In fact, when we mimic the body, we emphasize the fact that people run. These guys, man's best friend, they also are built to run, and they happen to get it a little bit better than we do. So the first lesson that you need to take away is that you need to turn off your stopwatch, your heart rate monitor, and all those tools, and turn on your smile when you get out for a run. And when you do, you'll start the first step in learning how to run. Second step takes a little bit longer. So we need to take a little bit of a water break and spend some time, find a coach, get a book. Chi running, pose running, there are lots of instructional material out there for you, but you need to learn how to run correctly like your kids do. They know that they take off their shoes and they use the Achilles tendon and they use the arch of their foot to do all of that shock absorption when they run. And we know that in modern architecture, arches are strong and they withstand earthquakes and they withstand big storms, but for some reason we've forgotten that these arches are also in our feet and they can also absorb the impact. So we need to take a step and rediscover, kind of like eating raw fish for the first time and you're discovering that you used to cook it and it actually tastes good raw. You need to rediscover the raw capabilities that are in your body. So the last thing you need to do, and these are my kids from our trip to the grocery store, is if the store is too far to walk to, run. You can carry the bags in your hands or in a backpack, whatever you want to do, or a meeting. Next time you have a big meeting or maybe a small meeting, invite a colleague for a half an hour run. With the blood rushing to your head, it's going to be way more effective than an hour sitting behind a desk. Commuting, I commuted here. It's possible. I don't look too goofy, right? But you get out of the traffic and you avoid the problems of commuting. Sightseeing, this is my favorite. When you go to a city, get out and run. The soul of the city will reveal itself to you in 1 or 2 hours while you run around it, and you'll know more about the city than anyone else. So, smile, learn how to run with a good form, and incorporate running into your life. And look for my book, The Definition of Running. Thank you.
Thank you, Josh. Our next speaker has an interesting distinction. She was actually the very first person to give an Ignite talk ever in 2006. So, and this is her fourth time on the Ignite stage. So Shelley Farnham will speak about why she hates Facebook.
Yes, I definitely have a love-hate relationship with Facebook. I am a research scientist that specializes in social media, but today I really wanted to convey my message to you as a personal story. My distress began a number of years ago. I was giving a talk about online identity, and I wanted to show a screenshot of my Facebook profile. But I felt a little strange exposing or communicating who I was in a relationship with at work, and so I went and I removed my relationship status. Facebook proceeds to send a message to all 700 my friends, colleagues, and coworkers. I'm no longer in a relationship. I really appreciated the sympathy I received, but I thought, wow, Facebook just doesn't get it. Now, my problem largely arises from the fact that I very actively live in two different life modes. On the one hand, I'm a very serious, studious, analytical person as a researcher. On the other hand, I'm an artist. I like to party. I like to do large-scale collaborative projects with my amazing community of creative friends. Yes, I am talking about the Black Rock City here, otherwise known as Burning Man. Burning Man, for those of you who don't know, has some potentially quite stigmatizing stereotypes associated with it. It's a bunch of drug-induced, polyamorous hippies partying in the desert. I promise I'm only there for the art, which is very amazing. Seriously. Do my colleagues need to see just how much fun I'm having? This picture, I promise, is not as bad as it looks, but I want you to feel my pain. This, you know, bleeds from one context to the other. When your different areas of life become merged in social media like this, it's called context collapse. Context collapse can quite meaningfully, negatively impact your well-being. What makes you effective and respected in one area of your life is not what makes you effective and respected in another area. And the stress or loss of optimal functioning you might experience as these roles collide is called role strain, and it is very real. Don't get me wrong, I love Facebook. I love connecting to every person I know or have ever met. And I have tried to use their tools to manage my sharing effectively, but they're actually quite difficult. They're very cumbersome, and you become complacent and overshare. This is my dog, Maddie, when she got attacked by a pit bull. I was very mad, and I wanted the pit bull owner, who was a friend of a friend in Facebook, to know about the severity of this attack. I was actually on the way to a conference at the time with some really well-respected colleagues of mine, and I had to miss the conference. But they found out about this incident and gave me the award for the best reason to miss a conference ever. And I have to admit, I felt very exposed by that. The Facebook leadership would argue that, in fact, you should be able to have one identity that's transparent for all. And, in fact, there's something wrong with you if you can't. This strikes me as the kind of attitude you might develop as a privileged white male working in a high-demand industry where you don't need to worry about losing your job. Take, for example, someone who's gay, who's working in a socially conservative bank. Is he lacking integrity if he doesn't want to share or have those worlds collide? I also think as an artist that sometimes it's important to have those siloed, isolated areas to really feel free to be as creative and self-expressive as you want. Actually, Burning Man's a good example of that. It is socially isolated from mainstream society, and because of that, it's one of the most creative environments you'll ever experience. When social media merges your world, basically you are impelled to only say things that are safe for everyone to see, and really that's pretty vanilla. I'm not arguing for privacy tools here. Privacy tools imply a spigot where you sort of control how much information flows. I'm arguing for boundary management. I want to share excessively, but I just want to share with the right people at the right time. So I actually thought what you do in email is you actually go in and you create another account. I'll try that with Facebook. Facebook does not appreciate this. They sent me this reasonably unpleasant letter saying that that violates their terms of service, one account per person. Turns out a lot of people have tried this. They've tried to create multiple accounts. It's about 5% of the people they estimate have these duplicate accounts. So what I would like to suggest to Facebook that in addition to creating better boundary management tools, they also make it okay to have more than one account in their terms of service. It's a part of a new strategy for really respecting people's boundaries and recognize that it's up to the users to really decide how to best segment their lives.
Thank you, Shelley. So lessons in life and work can come from some surprising places. So next up is Colin Henry, and he'll be talking about the Petty Officer School of Management. Give it up for Colin.
Everyone keep clapping. Monica's doing a great job tonight. Everyone give her a big round of applause. All right. So I'm here to tell you a story of terror and learning and leadership. When I joined Simply Measured in June of last year, I was excited. I got to work with a cool group of my friends, awesome, really awesome problems. Life couldn't be better for an engineer who just worked in an enterprise software company for the last 3 years. But I was absolutely terrified because when I took this job, I took it as director of engineering, and I had never run a team more than two people in my entire career, and I had no experience in professional management. So later that summer, I ran across this phrase, the petty officer is the Navy. A petty officer, for guys of you who don't know, are the non-commissioned officers in the United States Navy. They're the most senior enlisted you can be, short of being an officer. Some of you guys may recognize petty officers from the movies, Viggo Mortensen, Robert De Niro, and everyone knows the Master Chief. If you don't, you really should go play a video game. But these are the guys I'm actually talking about. These are lead division officers for the 316th Expeditionary Naval Forces. These are guys that are not only the best sailors in the world, but they have to manage teams of up to 250 per billet. This kind of resonated for me because I'm a Navy brat born and raised. I keep a challenge coin in my pocket. I've been all around the world. And some of you guys are going to say, that's a great story, but what the hell does this have to do with management? Did I sit and watch, you know, G.I. Jane and Men of Honor on for repeated times on the weekend, or did I actually talk to petty officers? Well, I'm a bit of a bookworm, and there happens to be a book on this. It's called The Blue Jacket Manual. It is the senior enlisted guide for all non-commissioned officers. And it lays out all of the rules, all of the structure, all of the layout. So what I would like to do right now is go through a couple of the lessons I've learned while applying this in practice with a team of now almost 20 people in the entire company and a team of 10 for engineering. Lesson number one, your priorities. Your priorities are your mission, your people, and then yourself. Your mission is whatever your CEO, your board of directors, your boss gives you. Next, your people. You need to make sure they're well taken care of and executing effectively. Make sure they're well compensated. Make sure their morale is high. Last, worry about yourself, because at that point, you can worry about your own career. Second, be the first one through the door. There's going to be a lot of bullshit flying when you're leading a team. You need to be able to block that from your people so they can execute effectively. Also, you need to make sure any of the major obstacles are out of their way so that you can minimize the time they spend on the nonsense. Spend more on time on nonsense than they do. Third, never ask anyone to do something that you're not willing or able to do yourself. You guys are put in leadership positions because you're the best at what you do. Occasionally, you're gonna have to do it and not just stand and be in meetings all day. Last, train your people. You could get hit by a bus tomorrow. You could go have to have major surgery. Hell, you may even quit. But the mission is going to have to continue even after you're gone. Train your people and make sure you trust the decisions they'll make in your absence. My rule of thumb, I should be able to take a two-week vacation to a desert island with no phone, no internet connection. And when I get back, nothing will have changed. No major fires have happened. Laugh if you want. The result of what we've gotten so far, the company's now 35 people, and I lead a team of 15 people. I've reorganized, and all of my guys that report to me directly and have people reporting to them follow this method. I'm Colin Henry. I'm JC Henry on Twitter. Thank you very much.
Colin Henry, giving a 5-minute lecture called The Petty Officer School of Management. He spoke as part of Ignite Seattle, an event that offers speakers a chance to quickly talk about a topic of their choice. The event took place at Town Hall on November 8th, 2012. You can learn more and hear the entire presentation by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
More from Ignite Seattle in a moment. 823 94.9 KUOW. David Allen talks about the ideas in his best-selling book, Getting Things Done, The Art of Stress-Free Productivity. That's tonight at 10:30. We're going to hear some of what Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas said today to the UN General Assembly before it voted overwhelmingly to grant limited statehood status to the Palestinians. Also, reaction to that UN-Palestine vote from a spokesman for Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu. Israel voted no on the Palestinian statehood proposition. Yet another reaction, this one from Michael Bell, Canada's former ambassador to both Israel and the Palestinian territories. Also, an off-duty RCMP officer picks up a hitchhiker and, while conversing with him, finds out something he didn't expect to find out. Scientists from the U.S. and Spain have found that there may be something to the technique of ridding yourself of negative thoughts by writing them down on a piece of paper, then discarding that piece of paper. And a McGill University professor talks about creating a website that collects complaints about United Airlines and about United taking him to court over it. All these items tonight in the 11 o'clock hour. Weather forecast for the Seattle area for tonight. Lows in the 40s, mostly cloudy with scattered showers this evening. After that, numerous showers. For Friday and Friday night, highs around 50, lows somewhere in the 40s, and rain at times. Looking ahead to Saturday, highs around 50, rain at times early in the day, otherwise mostly cloudy with scattered showers. And breezy, too.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. If you had 5 minutes on stage, what would you say? That's the premise of Ignite Seattle, a yearly event where speakers get just 5 minutes to lecture on a topic of their choice. This year's event took place on November 8th, 2012 at Town Hall. It was moderated by Seattle Times columnist Monica Guzman.
5 years ago, our next speaker was in a very scary place. She was in a classroom at Virginia Tech when a gunman opened fire. Christina Anderson will talk about the Virginia Tech massacre.
Thank you. My parents are in the crowd tonight. Thank you guys so much for coming. My name is Christina. I'm going to tell you about the craziest day of my life. It happened when I was a sophomore at Virginia Tech. That day started like a very normal day for me. I was sleeping in, so I was about to miss my first class. My friend drove me to class that morning, and I made two decisions that seemed small but had a huge impact. One was that I chose to wear sneakers instead of my usual flip-flops, and two was that I actually went to class, which didn't happen pretty often. Sorry, Dad. We're heading to Norris Hall. Norris is an L-shaped building. It's old. What's interesting about it is it only has three exits. The room that we're in right now has four. We climb the stairs to the second floor of Norris. This is the remodeled version that you guys are looking at. And most of the doors are closed because classes have started, so we have to count down and find 211. Right as we enter our room, my teacher, Madame Couture Novak, she's standing at the front, and she, you know, welcomes us with this, like, grim face of, like, why are you late? Every morning, she would move us around the classroom so we would get to work with new people. Because we were often late, we always missed this part. So this is pretty important. This day, I ended up sitting in exactly the same seat I always did, in the back right-hand corner on the right side of the class. What we don't know is at this time, someone is downstairs, and he's chaining all three doors shut. There's supposed to be desks there. Oh, you guys can see. We heard the first gunshots outside in the hallway, and my teacher, she opened the door. She immediately slammed it, and she said, call 911. And the second that door closed, he walks in. He walks in shooting. There's absolutely no time. He goes to the other side of the classroom by the windows. He's holding two guns. He doesn't say anything. He just starts going down the rows of people. It's very quick. It's very loud. It's very scary. We had these very shitty desks. I get on the floor. I put my knees under the chair, my stomach on the seat, hands overhead, eyes are closed. As the shots keep going, and it's, like I said, very loud, I can tell it's getting closer and closer. And I'm telling myself, brace yourself, your turn is going to come. Now, I didn't know what that meant. Like, I didn't think I was going to get shot, but I knew that something really serious was going on. And I knew, for whatever reason, that I should just play dead. He shoots me. The first time's in the back. And you'd be surprised. Getting shot doesn't hurt that much because shock overtakes you. But it starts to, like, burn and really kind of seep in, and that's when it gets really uncomfortable. It's not pleasant. He leaves the first time. He goes across the hall. And while he's gone, cell phones are ringing. People are coughing. And the smell of gunpowder has, like, completely filled the room. Gunpowder is like this really sticky, pungent, warm smell. And it just makes you very, very thirsty. He comes back. Now, this time, the shooting is more intermittent. It's slower because he's looking to see who's alive. I remember telling myself to stop breathing because I can feel my stomach hitting that chair, and I'm saying, stop, like, he can see that you're alive. The third and final time, he killed himself in front of our classroom. When the police broke in, the first thing the guy said was, we have a lot of blacks in here. I didn't know what that meant, but when police sweep a crime scene, they have 30 seconds. If you're red, you're critically injured. If you're yellow, you'll live. Black means you're dead. In 9 minutes, he killed 11 of my classmates and my teacher. 32 people lost their lives that day. This was like a huge, huge event. Now, they carried us outside of Norris Hall, and they threw us on the grass, and they tore up my jeans to see where I'm shot. Now, remember, I'm 19, so I'm thinking, like, what color underwear am I wearing right now? They were, like, super bright. But she tells me I'm shot, and I'm a red tag, so I go to the hospital immediately into surgery. Thankfully, he missed all the vital organs. They still took some out. The third bullet went in my right toe, which I probably wouldn't have if it weren't for those shoes. I love those shoes. I've learned a lot of things about this, but the most basic thing I learned is that life is incredibly short. It doesn't matter if you get 20 years or 50 years or 70 years. All that matters is that you appreciate what you have. So whatever it is that you do, my message is, like, whether it be in work or in life, or in play, or if it's in traffic tonight, appreciate that you get that moment, and never ever forget how wonderful traffic can really be sometimes. If you have any questions, come find me afterwards, or there's my Twitter as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Wow. Thanks for sharing that. Our next speaker is going to speak about something about which he's very passionate, and that's forgiveness.
So please welcome Matt Lawrence.
It's probably not ironic that I'm up next. I used to think forgiveness was something that we did to make somebody else feel better, or something that happened in the movies when somebody did something really bad. Well, recently, something happened and it changed my perspective a little bit. Some friends of mine were in a rough spot in their marriage, and they asked me if I could help kind of smooth things out. And I was having a hard time with it, and I came home and I asked my wife, how do I make two people forgive each other? And she said, well, have they tried praying? No, I hadn't thought about that. I actually wanted to tell them some concrete steps to take. And she said, well, what were the concrete steps that you took when you forgave your brother? And I didn't have an answer to that. 18 years later, and I hadn't gotten around to that. My mom and my brother left Chicago to pick me up in La Crosse, Wisconsin. My 1973 Volkswagen Bug had broken down yet again. And my mom said, I've got a room for you at the Holiday Inn. Just go there. We're going to come pick you up. But it was late, and my brother was young. And he was driving into the night, and there was an accident. And my mom died. And thankfully, my brother walked away safely. And he and I immediately started the process of stuffing our feelings, anger and sadness and regret and shame. And we decided immediately that we had to be big and we had to be bold and we had to prove to the world that we were going to be able to overcome this. And it was time for us to be adults. But we weren't adults. We were just these little kids. And we had to go to college and we had to have jobs. And I had a lot of whiskey to drink. So I thought that I was the type of person that was going to talk through this type of tragedy, and that I would never stuff my anger and pretend like it wasn't there. But I did. And I realized that thanks to my wife, that there was something that I had to do, because I got home and she said, what did you do to forgive your brother? And I was upset. I said, how dare you suggest that there was anything that he needed to be forgiven for? He was innocent. But then the rest of me was just tired of pretending that I wasn't angry anymore. And so I asked myself, could I forgive my brother for not making it a little farther? Could I forgive my mom for not wearing a seatbelt? Could I forgive myself for putting myself in a position where I needed to be rescued? And I said, yeah, I can. And so the next step I did was I named it. I named the actual things that I was angry about. I was angry at my brother for falling asleep at the wheel. And I was angry at my mom for being so irresponsible, utterly irresponsible, and at myself for being so selfish. And then I was like, well, can I just let go of all that crap? Can I move on? And I was like, yes, I can. Please, I want to. And so I committed. I committed to forgiving us all. And the next step was magic, and it made the rest of my life since that moment better. The relationship my brother and I have now is the best it's been in 18 years. And what I needed to do was examine myself. I needed to look in and see like a full body scan, where it prints out a report and it actually names all of the things that you're actually angry about. And I took each one of those and I looked at the words, anger. And I was able to let it go. And through that, I was able to commit to forgiveness. And the next step was out of my control. And it was just grace. Grace took over everything. And it washed away all of my anger and sadness. And I was, rather than absolving, I was actually absolved. Because grace was the thing that came in and took over. And I was free from it. Forgiveness is a really great gift that you can give somebody else. But it's actually the best gift that you can give yourself. Thanks for your time.
Our next speaker is a very special guest. We are honored to have join us on the Ignite stage. Mayor Mike McGinn will speak about the city of the future. Mayor McGinn.
I just want to say, I've heard all of these incredibly amazing personal stories, and I'm just going to talk about my job. So it's the 50th anniversary of the World's Fair. It's going to be the city of the future. And we've all been remembering that World's Fair and the city of future. It was all flying cars and jetpacks and monorails everywhere. And in fact, I was being introduced by John Keister of Almost Live fame at the kickoff of the Next 50 celebration. And he said, "What happened? We were promised flying cars. You know, we were promised jetpacks. Now we have a mayor that wants us to ride a bike. What happened?" And I laughed, and, you know, I thought of the line of the great American philosopher, Yogi Berra, you know, the future ain't what it used to be. And, you know, the future ain't what it used to be. So what is the city of the future? And I've fallen behind. It's transit. We have a transit master plan. It's in the city of the future, right? Shouldn't we build transit for the city? It's broadband. It's broadband. We're trying to squeeze data through lines that were built for cable and TVs. Why don't we just build a big, fat data pipe and use TV and cable and phone as apps on that data pipe? We have a fiber optic network throughout the entire city. We have dark fiber. We have advertised that dark fiber for sale so that we can partner with the private sector to build fiber optic to the premise. It's mixed-use communities. That's kind of a throwback. It used to be that everybody wanted to move out to the suburbs. Big home, fast commute in the car. Right? And what was the first thing you did when you were 16? You got a driver's license. It's flipped. We're in the middle of a great demographic inversion. People want to live in town. They want to text. That's what 16-year-olds do now. Right? And so people want to live here again, and that's great. So what we have to do is invest in great mixed-use places. It's education. I've been talking about physical infrastructure of a city, but the social infrastructure. It's about education. We have to give people opportunity. We have to train people for jobs that are already in the workforce and help them find their place in the world, too. And we've launched programs around our families and Ed Levy, Pathways to Careers, Career Bridge, in which we can give people that connection to opportunity. It's diversity. We are so fortunate to be a port city, a place where people come from all over the world, because we benefit from that diversity. But our challenge is to get over our own prejudices and stereotypes so we can appreciate the fullness that everyone can share with us. It's race and social justice as well. These are elements of a great city. Now, we have to connect people to each other. We have to connect people to opportunities, and government's got a race to catch up, too. We have to connect, too. That's why I go out to town halls. That's why we do these. This is why we create all these wonderful apps where we push information out to you, dataseattle.gov, our WindWatch, SnowWatch, RainWatch, Where's My Snowplow. But we also have to create interactive apps. No, we have GPS on the snowplow. You can see where it is. We have to have But we're good at pushing info out. We have to figure out how to listen and interact with you. That's the next generation. Here's why it matters, though. I want to talk about this. I'm talking about connecting, and it is a good of and in itself. But we need to connect with each other because it's in the connections that ideas and innovation happen. Think about science. The best ideas are at the edges of the disciplines. Think about music. It's when music combines and recombines. That's what happens in a community when we create places where artists, scientists, entrepreneurs, diverse people get together. And that fuels our economy. And it's not new economy versus old economy, right? Everybody has to innovate. And it's working. We have the fourth fastest growing city in the nation. So I want to get back to the World's Fair. We can make fun of what they thought the future was, but they got one thing exactly right, that we would be the city of the future by focusing on innovation, science, arts and culture. And we've done that the last 50 years. We were just this little rain-soaked city in the corner of the continent that nobody knew where it was, and 50 years later, everybody knows about us. We have this reputation, and we have this reputation not just for innovation and arts and science and software and coffee. We have a reputation for equal rights. Anybody can marry who they want to marry. We have a reputation for being green and environmental. And do you know why we have that reputation, folks? And this is the most important point. I'm running out of time. You built that reputation. The people in this room makes this city the city of the future. And I just want to say thank you to all of you for everything you do to make this a really great city. Thank you.
Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn, giving a 5-minute lecture called City of the Future. He spoke as part of Ignite Seattle, an event that offers speakers a chance to briefly talk about a topic of their choice. The event took place at Town Hall on November 8th, 2012. You can learn more and hear the entire presentation by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
More from Ignite Seattle in a moment, 841 94.9 KUOW. In one of the most complex ecosystems in the world, a vicious battle for resources is underway. The Galapagos Islands of Ecuador have long been considered a crown jewel of pristine nature. First made famous by Charles Darwin, who developed his theory of evolution while visiting the islands, the Galapagos have since struggled with their celebrity, trying to balance the desire for conservation with the demands of tourism and the needs of the local population. Playwright Michael Hollinger spun these overlapping tensions into a rich and compelling story loosely based on true events which occurred there in the 1990s. Tooth and Claw by Michael Hollinger in an L.A. Theater Works production tomorrow evening at 10 o'clock. Forecast for the Seattle area for tonight, lows in the 40s, mostly cloudy with isolated showers this evening, then numerous showers. For Friday and Friday night, highs around 50, lows in the 40s, rain at times. And for Saturday, highs around 50, rain at times early in the day, otherwise mostly cloudy with scattered showers, and breezy. Seattle jazz mainstay Overton Berry talks about the lively scene he and his trio created in the 1970s at the Doubletree Inn, and about the retrospective album The Overton Berry Trio at Seattle's Doubletree Inn. Also, the trio performs some music from the album. A look at the life and career of Lucille Bliss, whose voice characterizations included the title character of the very first made-for-television cartoon, Crusader Rabbit, and Smurfette on the popular 1980s cartoon, The Smurfs. Lucille Bliss died on November 8th at the age of 96. And journalist and author Simon Winchester talks about his recent book, Skulls, an exploration of Alan Dudley's curious collection. All three of these items next hour, beginning right after the 9 o'clock news.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Ignite Seattle is an annual event where speakers get 5 minutes to deliver a lecture on a topic of their choice. In November, a variety of people took the stage at Seattle's Town Hall in the attempt to enlighten the audience in just 5 minutes. Next, Lee LaFever talks about the art of explaining.
Thanks. My name is Lee LaFever, and I'm the founder of a company called Common Craft. And since 2007, I've been a professional explainer, mainly through videos with paper cutouts. And tonight, I want to help you think differently about explanation. And I'll do that through a story of a woman named Shelby, who is a talented woman working as a development lead at a software company. But she has a problem. She can't seem to help other people understand what she's trying to say. She has a problem with explanation. So she has a meeting with her manager and says that this problem is keeping her from getting resources for her team. And the manager asks a question that she didn't expect. She said, "Have you ever thought about building explanation skills?" Shelby had never actually even thought about this before. She explains things every day and thought that explanation was just something that was a built-in part of her life, like how she eats or how she walks. She was skeptical. Could she actually improve how she explains things? Her manager saw an opportunity and said, "You're right. We explain things every day. In fact, we take it for granted. But the best explanations can actually make us successful and interesting. We are all explainers. But the problem is that we rarely take a step back and think about what makes an explanation work. We dive into a presentation without a plan, and then we get upset when people don't get it, they don't understand. The manager said that to solve this problem, we have to understand the cause. And she described what's called the curse of knowledge, which means that when you know something so thoroughly, it makes it hard for you to understand what it's like not to know. These incorrect assumptions make it hard for you to understand what it's like to be in another person's shoes. And those inaccurate assumptions cause your explanations to fail. Another thing that causes explanations to fail is this idea of the cost of understanding. That if someone's learning something new, they look at that learning as something that has a cost. And if the cost seems too high, they might walk away. And the role of an explainer is to lower that cost and make it easy. So her manager asked her, "What are you trying to explain now?" She said, "Agile development. This is the hardest thing for me to explain right now. Nobody gets it." So the manager says, "Great, we have a problem to solve. And what we're going to do is create a plan for using explanations to solve that problem. We're going to package ideas into an explanation that you can use from now on." He went up to the whiteboard and drew out some stepping stones and said, at the beginning of an explanation, we need to give people an invitation to care and feel interested and confident that this is going to be something they can understand. The next thing we'll do is build context. This is not talking about the idea. It's building a world around the idea. It's talking about the forest first and then talking about the trees. Shelby took notes. Maybe she could talk about her team's role in the company and their goal for efficiency. Or maybe she could talk about the old way that they've done development and why it doesn't work for them anymore. The next subject was about telling stories. And her manager said, your story doesn't have to be a big developed story arc. They could just be about a person who has a problem, who finds a solution, and then feels happy. And that's a really basic story format. She said, don't forget connections. Connect your ideas to ideas that your audience already understands. Use analogies. And always remember to adjust your language to your audience's experiences. Shelby could see that it was coming together, that these simple stepping stones were becoming a plan for solving an explanation problem, and that the next step was to take that plan and write a script that represented her explanation. She saw that explanations could be written. These days, Shelby is an explanation maven at her company. Her explanations have improved. She's got resources for her team. And all the people in the development part of the company want to know her secret. And that's where we are today. I personally believe very strongly that explanations are a powerful skill. And that I want the world to be more understandable, a more understandable place to live and work. And to do that, I need your help. We need more explainers. We need people who build explanation skills and use those skills to create change and solve problems. And that's really what I want to talk about today. Thanks so much for having me. I'm Lee LaFever. Go Sounders!
Thank you, Lee. Our next speaker is going to talk about something she's afraid of and how she confronted that fear. So Shauna Causey is going to get up here on stage in front of all you people and talk about her fear of public speaking. Shauna.
Thanks, Monica. All right, so when was the last time that you confronted a fear? I mean, something that you were really, really nervous about. You're anxious, maybe your palms were sweaty. I mean, really something that was difficult. Well, here are the most Googled fears. Some of you may be able to identify with a few of these, just like me. I have not seen the movie Snakes on a Plane, but somehow that one seems to take the cake with most of these fears. Well, I'm here today to talk a little bit about my biggest fear, as it was public speaking. I mean, I was mortified of public speaking, and it really started to intensify as I got older. And it all kind of, the one thing that comes to mind when I think about it is being in high school and looking out to a crowd just like this and literally blacking out. Like, I don't remember what happened next. All I remember is I went and sat back down. That's about pretty much all I remember. I was truly terrified of public speaking, and it just seemed to get worse and worse throughout college. So fast forward to about 5 years ago, and I started being asked to share knowledge in groups through work and then also through my nonprofit board service. So I decided that I was going to confront this head on. I was going to say yes to speaking for one entire year. Well, what happened after that? Number one, doubt, self-doubt. I was like, I would rather run. I would rather find something else to do than that. And then the other one, I thought, well, what if I procrastinate? I'd actually rather take surfing lessons. That sounds like so much more fun. Then I started to get advice from some friends as I shared this journey. And I did hear the cliche, hey, why don't you just imagine all of you with no clothes on, right? Well, think about doing that for an entire year. I don't think so. That was not going to happen. I didn't do that one. So I started saying yes. So this is my first speaking opportunity. I was asked to speak at the United Way in Bremerton. And again, this is all volunteer work. So I get up at 4 a.m., go speak to these five women, and I had a blast. I had so much fun. And I started to get over this fear. And then all of a sudden, through work, I was asked to give the opening statements, the welcome at the tree lighting on Westlake Center. So here I am. This is my photo. I'm looking out into thousands of people, and I was terrified, but somehow I got through it. And one of the things that I learned, too, throughout this journey was that you have to be able to take feedback. So one of the things that I heard, about 6 months later, I had my first keynote, and I was up there at a nonprofit conference. Looking out into the crowd, Gates Foundation, it was an awesome audience, and I thought the talk went okay. And then I left the stage, and I talked to a few people afterwards, and somebody came up and they said, hey, you had some really good points in your talk, but you spoke so fast, I thought you were going to grow wings and start flying around the room. So you got to be able to take feedback. And then, the other thing is you get feedback that's not constructive. And if you put yourself out there, you're going to have these hecklers, people who just want to bring you down. It's just going to happen. So you have to acknowledge them and just move on. They're just out there. The other thing that I did is I did hire a public speaking coach to help me a little bit. And TJ Walker, he's amazing. And this feedback, actually, nobody knows this except for my family. But what I did is I put, he gave me the advice to put sticky notes on the wall with little eyes on them and little faces all along the wall and to practice. So when I was starting out, I spent hours in front of these sticky notes just talking to the wall so I could be decent when I was in front of a crowd. It was a lot of work. So things that I wish somebody would have told me when I set out on this journey. I actually ended up speaking at 60 events. I volunteered at 60 different events. Most of them were small nonprofit events and boards. But I learned a few things. Number one is so few of us set goals for ourselves. It's so important, and it's really changed my life in many ways to set personal and professional goals. Just write down what I want to do. And then put myself in these situations where I can actually be challenged. And for me, that meant serving on nonprofit boards and volunteering to help when I could. And the third one, which is really good news, is after you confront your fear a few times, then it just gets so easy. It's actually fun, and it's almost addictive. So you'll want to do it more. You'll want to put yourself in these situations where you're challenged more and more. So really what I want to say, Oprah says there's things she knows for sure. I know for sure that if I confronted my fear and I was truly terrified of public speaking, then if you guys have something that you're thinking about or a fear or a challenge, I'm positive that you can do it. I'm absolutely positive. So I have a challenge for each of you in this room. Think about something that you want to do, whether it's starting a blog, running the Seattle Marathon, motorcycle lessons, learning to ride a motorcycle, which is something I want to do. And then stick with it. Figure out how long you're going to do it, whether it's a week, a month, or a year. And by the way, I'd love to know how it goes since I went through it myself. So thank you so much.
A lot of us probably think we have superpowers in one way or another. Our next speaker, Alex Alviar, is going to talk about the secret superpowers of being deaf. Alex.
Thank you. I want to start by talking about what it means to be deaf, and then I'll get to the superpower part. There's actually two definitions, and I'm really good at both of these. But I'm going to focus on the first one, what it means to be of impaired hearing. I was born with a severe to profound hearing loss, which put me at the bottom of the chart. That means I grew up with a hearing aid, a lot of speech therapy, but no sign language. And it was a risky bet by my mother, but it paid off. In fact, the only sign that I know is the American sign for I love you, the gang sign for the blood with the pretzel hand syndrome, and little Mikey Wilson's enthusiasm for the Dutch Rotterdam soccer team. When I was 25, I suffered a second hearing loss that took it down even further and got a cochlear implant, which bypasses the eardrum and plays your auditory nerve like a piano. They've gotten better over the years, and now I'm just waiting for the upgrade that will help me assimilate a lot more. But it's not obvious that I have an implant. I don't hear out of my left ear, and the TSA often thinks that I'm rude for wearing my Bluetooth. Unlike that guy on the lower left who has a cochlear implant but had no such excuse. And it's not easy being a superhero. I spent a lot of time alone on the playground as a kid, being teased and the like. And in high school, my friend Matt gifted me in our yearbook all those little things you missed that you made a big deal over. And there's no shortage of people who think that I'm deaf and dumb because I talk pretty or because I don't hear a question asked. There's even something known as the deaf smile, which is where I smile gregariously, even though I didn't hear something. And it turns out someone just told me they had cancer. And like any superhero, there is a weakness, which is too much sound. I have no real natural ability to discriminate background noise, so it hit me like a wall. A little bit of it can leave me exhausted or irritated. It's kind of like at the mall or at the bar or even the low hum of the air conditioner. It's kind of like having three kids screaming at you at one time. Even the government has used it, like when they blasted the Waco compound with songs from Barney the Dinosaur. But it's not all bad. There are superpowers. There's an upside. Hidden abilities and talent call from a lifetime of being deaf. And many of you may relate to some of these. They're not exclusive to being deaf. So here we go. One, if I had a nickel for every time someone asked me, where's your accent from? I'd be able to afford a Capitol Hill commune. But I don't always carry my dual citizenship passport, but I do always have my speech impediment. Some of you might have guessed this. I can lip read across the room, especially people are talking about things that happened in Vegas. But sometimes I can make a mistake, like when someone says olive juice and I say, I love you too. And because I'm in such a habit of lip reading, I look at people and intensely. And there's no two ways about it. People usually think I'm very authentically engaged or I'm excessively attached. And since I was little, I've always taken off my implant or my hearing aid to go to sleep. So it's like a Pavlovian response. I take it off and I can fall asleep just about anywhere, every time, anytime. I also take it off when I shower, but fortunately that has not killed me yet. And when I take it off, I don't hear anything at all. Which is awesome when you have a kid and your wife does all the waking up at night. I love you, honey. It also means I've slept through a lot of fire alarms. Now, here's the complicated one. There's also something weird when you don't have context for everything you're hearing. Lots of ordinary experiences become kind of surreal, like an alternate reality. When I was little, I remember listening to the Pledge of Allegiance and not understanding the words. It was really spooky. And don't get me started on dancing either. And because my brain is always trying to fill in gaps, it's often trying to anticipate what's going to be said next. It's like kind of trying to figure out the picture on the left instead of really starting with the one on the right, something I've gotten to be very good at. In English, there's one word for love. In Greek, there's many words for love. And just like that, the kids from Ecuador actually developed their own sign, and with it, a new way of thinking and new concepts. And I do that often, putting together visuals with sound to create concepts in my head. And the second time I lost my hearing, I didn't know if I'd ever be able to hear again, much less be able to work professionally. So Helen Keller once said that deafness is the worst because it cut.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.